60. Depending on where you began the story, it was about Sunduck. She had not meant to be an international art dealer and small-time crime boss. It had begun as a mere desire for something more, and then a slow realization that something more was never going to be reachable on her current path. She was married to a clever man she'd met in Hong Kong, and she had several bright children who mostly took after him except for the one, and she had seen how her life would play out. Then she had gone mad. It hadn't been a long madness. A year, perhaps, of fits and visions and being found prowling through the streets. And when she had come out the other side, she had discovered that she had a psychic's eyes and a shaman's touch, and that she was going to make a career of it. She'd renamed herself Sunduck, and the legend had been born. She handled wonder every day. The robotic bee was the moment she realized she was on a fated path. Henry, her middle son, shone brightly, but he never seemed able to direct that light outside of himself. And so when Neil Lynch offered to find her a bauble, a token, a magical toy that would help him, she was listening. The beautiful bee struck her the moment she saw it. Of course, he had also shown it to L'Aumônier, and to Greenmantle, and to Valquez, and to Mackie, and to She. But that was to be expected because he was a scoundrel and could not help himself. But when he had met Henry, he had let Sunduck have it for nearly nothing, and she would not forget that. Of course, it had been a gift and a penalty, since later L'Aumônier had kidnapped Henry for it. She would have revenge for that. She didn't regret it. She couldn't make herself regret it, even when it threatened her children. This was a fated path, and she felt right on it, even when it was hard. When she found herself next to the Gray Man, Greenmantle's old hired muscle, in an off-campus Aglimby Academy lot, and discovered that the blood on his shoes was L'Aumônier's, she was instantly interested in what he had to say. "A brave new way of doing business," the Gray Man said in a low voice, as the parking lot was quickly beginning to fill up with a small but potent number of forbidding-looking people. It was not that they looked dangerous, necessarily, just odd in a way that suggested they didn't look at the world at all like you did. They were a very different group than the people who had come to the school the night before. Technically, both gatherings had a lot to do with politics. An ethical way. There are no armed guards outside of furniture stores to prevent people from bludgeoning employees and carrying out sofas. That is the business I want.
"That will not be an easy goal," Sunduck said, her voice also low.
She kept her eyes on the cars pulling up and also on her phone. She knew that Henry had been told to stay away, and she trusted him to keep his head down, but she also didn't trust L'Aumônier in the slightest. There was no point tempting them by showing that Henry, and by extension his bee, were within close proximity.
"The people have gotten used to carrying sofas, and one does not like to stop stealing sofas when others haven't yet agreed to."
"Persuasion might be required at the beginning," the Gray Man admitted.
"You are talking years."
"I am committed," he replied, "so long as I can get a decent number of people who are interested in that vision. People I like." Here was L'Aumônier, finally, one of them on the phone. His face suggested he was trying to contact the third one, but the third one was not in a condition to answer. The Gray Man would discuss this with them after the sale had happened, in a persuasive way, aided with some truly fantastic weapons that he had found on the Lynch farm. Sunduck said,
"I am not people you like."
"You are people I respect, which is nearly the same."
Her smile said she knew he was sucking up to her, and she accepted it nonetheless.
"Perhaps, Mr. Gray, this is according to my interest."
This was when Piper Greenmantle arrived. Well, it was not her at first. It was Dread first, then Piper.
The feeling struck them like a wave of nausea, rocking from feet to head, sending hands to throats and knees to pavement. It was early afternoon, but the sky suddenly seemed darker. This was the first sign that this sail was going to be something remarkable. So, first Dredd, then Piper. She arrived flying, which was the second sign that things were going to be somewhat unusual. When she landed, it became obvious that she had arrived on a rug of tiny black wasps, which dissolved when they touched the asphalt. She looked good. This was striking for several reasons. First, because rumor had it that she had died before her smarmy husband had been killed by wasps in his apartment, and she was clearly not dead. And secondly, because she was holding a black wasp that was nearly a foot long, and most people didn't look as serene and put together as she did when holding a stinging insect of any size. She strode over to L'Aumônier, clearly intending to cheek kiss. But they both bowed back from the insect. This was the third sign that things were going to be somewhat unusual, because L'Aumônier ordinarily made a point to never look alarmed. "This is not good," the gray man said under his breath, because it was obvious now that the dread was coming from either Piper or the wasp. The sensation kept hitting Sonduk in ill waves, reminding her painfully of her year of being mad. It took a moment for her to realize that it was verbally reminding her of her year of being mad. She could hear the words being said directly into her head, in Korean. "Thank you all for coming," Piper said grandly. She cocked her head, eyes narrowed, and Sonduk knew that she was being whispered to also. "Now that I am single, I intend to move independently into the business of luxury magical items, curating only the most extraordinary and otherworldly of crazy shit. I hope you all start to trust me to be a quality source. And our kickoff piece, the thing you've come all this way for, is this." She lifted her arm, and the wasp stepped a little farther toward her hand. The crowd shuddered as one. There was something quite wrong about it. The dread, plus the size, the real weight of it moving the fabric of her sleeve. "This is a demon." Yes, Sonduk believed this. "It's favored me, as you can probably tell by my fabulous hair and skin, but I'm ready to pass it along to the next user so I can find the next great thing. It's all about the journey, right?"
"Right."
"Is it?"
started one of the men in the group. Rodney, Sonduk believed his name was. He didn't seem to know how to finish his question.
"How does it work?" Sonduk asked.
"Mostly I just ask it to do stuff," Piper said, "and it goes for it.
I'm not really religious, but I feel like somebody with some religious background could really make it do some cool tricks.
It made me a house and these pumps. What could it do for you?"
"Stuff."
"Shall we start the bidding, Dan?"
L'Aumônier was still not quite recovered. The thing about being in the demon's presence was that it got worse instead of better. The opposite of getting used to it. That was the sensation. It was a wound that increased from ache to stab. The whispers were hard to bear because they were not really whispers. They were thoughts mingling helplessly with one's own, difficult to prioritize. Sonduk had survived a year of madness, though, and she could bear this. It was not impossible to tell which thoughts were the demons. They were the ugliest, the most backward, the ones that would unmake the thinker. A few of the folks in the back were leaving, retreating wordlessly toward their cars before things got ugly, uglier, ugliest.
"Hey," Piper said, "don't just walk away from me, demon."
The wasp twitched its antennae, and the people twitched in rhythm. They twirled, eyes wide.
"You see," Piper said through gritted teeth, "it's really quite handy."
"I think," L'Aumônier said cautiously, looking at the frozen buyers and then at the faces of their peers and then at his daughter,
This might not be the best method of displaying this particular good.
What he meant was, the demon was creeping everyone out, and it was hard to shake the idea that they might all die at any time, which was bad for business both present and future.
Don't use that passive-aggressive stuff on me, Piper said. I read an article on how you have basically been undercutting my personhood for my entire life, and that is totally an example.
This is totally an example of you overstepping your knowledge, Lemonnier said. Your ambition is constantly outstripping your education. You don't even know how to transfer a demon.
I'll wish it, don't you get it?
Piper asked.
It has to favor me. It has to do what I say.
But Sonduck wasn't sure that was the same thing.
Do you think... Lemonnier asked. Do you control it, or does it control you?
Oh, please, Piper said. Demon, unfreeze those people. Demon, make it sunny. Demon, change my clothing to all white. Demon, do as I say, do as I say.
The people unfroze. The sky turned white hot bright for just a second. Her clothing bleached. The demon buzzed up into the air. The whispering in Sonduck's head had become something fierce. Lemonnier shot his daughter. It made a little oomph sound because of the silencer. Lemonnier looked shocked. Both said nothing, just stared at her body, then up at the demon who had whispered it to them. Now everyone fled. If Lemonnier would shoot his daughter, anything could happen. The demon had landed upon the wound in Piper's neck, its legs sinking into the blood, its head lowered to the hole. It was changing. She was changing. Everything was unmaking and violence and perversion.
Call me, Sonduck told the gray man, and get out of here.
Piper's scream played backward. Sonduck had not realized she was still alive. The blood around her neck was black. Ambition, greed, hatred, violence, contempt. Ambition, greed, hatred, violence, contempt. She was dead. The demon began to rise. Unmake her. Unmake her. I wake. I wake. I wake.
61.
Adam could not decide if this was the worst thing that had happened to him, or if it felt that way because he had been so recently and senselessly happy that the comparison was making it so. He was in the back seat of the BMW, his hands still bound, his eyes still covered, one ear deaf. He didn't even feel real. He felt tired but not sleepy, worn by the effort of being unable to participate in his senses, and still the demon occasionally worked against the ribbon, how his skin sang with pain and rolled his eyes against his will. Blue sat beside him, and the orphan girl on the other side of her by his request. He didn't know if he could escape from the ribbon, but he knew that the demon would only hurt Blue in an effort to get to Ronan or the orphan girl, so at least they would have a warning if it happened again. God, God. He'd nearly killed Ronan. He would have killed him. He'd only just been making out with Ronan, and his hands would have nonetheless murdered him while Adam watched. How would he go to school? How would he do anything? His breath betrayed him because Blue leaned against his shoulder. Don't, he warned. She lifted her head, but then he felt her fingers in his hair instead, stroking it gently, and then touching the skin on his cheek where he had gouged himself. She didn't say anything. He closed his eyes behind the blindfold, listening to the slow patter of the rain on the windshield, the shoosh of the wipers. He had no idea how close they were to Cabe's water. Why couldn't he think of another way around the sacrifice? Gansey was only hurrying to do this because of him, because of how his bargain had turned this into an emergency. In the end, Adam was killing him anyway, just like in his vision. A backward, sideways version of the blame, but Adam at its helm just the same.
but it was undeniable that Adam was the one who'd made it an emergency. Bad feeling hissed inside Adam, but he couldn't tell if it was guilt or a warning from Cabe's water.
"What's that?" Gansey's voice came from the passenger seat. "On the road."
Blue drew away from Adam. He heard her pull herself between the driver's and passenger seats. She sounded dubious.
"Is it blood?"
"From what?" Ronan asked.
"Maybe not from anything," Gansey said. "Is it real?"
Ronan said. "The rain's hitting it."
Should we drive through it?"
Gansey asked.
"Blue, what's Henry's face look like? Can you see it?"
Adam felt Blue's body brush him as she swiveled to look in the Fisker behind them. His hand strained and twitched, endlessly hungry. The demon felt close.
Blue said, "Give me your phone. I'm going to call Mom."
"What's happening?" Adam asked.
"The road is flooded," Blue said. "It looks like blood, though. And there's something floating in it."
"What is that, Gansey? Is it petals? Blue petals?" There was a heavy silence in the car.
"Do you ever feel like things are coming full circle?" Ronan said in a low voice. "Do you?"
He didn't finish his sentence. The car was quiet again, unmoving. Apparently he hadn't decided whether or not to drive through the flood yet. Rain spattered. The windshield wipers clunk sighed again.
"I guess we..." "Jesus," Gansey broke off. "Jesus! Ronan!"
Terror coated his words.
"Ronan!"
repeated Gansey. There was a metallic slap, groan of a seat, scuffling.
The car shifted beneath them with the ferocity of Gansey shifting his weight.
Ronan still hadn't replied. A roar pitched low behind his words. The engine. Ronan was hitting the gas while the car was out of gear.
The sick warning in Adam had risen to an alarm.
The roar suddenly stopped. The car had been turned off.
"Oh, no," Blue said. "Oh, no, the girl, too." She moved away from Adam fast. He heard her open the door on the other side of the car. Cool, moist air sucked into the BMW. Another door opened, another. All of them but Adam's. Henry's voice came from outside, deep and serious and completely devoid of humor.
"What's happening?" Adam demanded.
"Can we..." Blue's voice was halfway to a sob, coming from outside the driver's side door.
"Can we pick it off him?"
"Don't," Ronan gasped. "Don't touch it. Don't."
The driver's seat knocked back so hard that it smashed into Adam's knees. Adam heard a sound that was unmistakably Ronan sucking in his breath.
"Oh, Jesus," Gansey said again. "Tell me what I can do."
Again, the seat bucked. Adam's hands clawed back against the seat behind him, quite against his will. Whatever was happening, they wanted to help it happen faster. From the front seat, Ronan's phone began to ring and ring and ring. It was the low, dull ring that Ronan had programmed for when Declan's number called. The worst was that Adam knew what that meant.
Something was happening to Matthew.
No, the worst was that Adam couldn't do anything about any of it.
"Ronan, Ronan, don't close your eyes," Blue said, and now she was crying. I'm calling Mom."
"Whoa, stand back," Gansey shouted. The entire car rocked.
Henry demanded, "What was that?"
"He's brought it back from his dreams," Gansey said. "When he passed out, it won't hurt us."
"What's happening?" Adam demanded.
Gansey's voice was low and miserable. It reached the edge and cracked. "He's being unmade."
62. It was impossible to believe that Adam had thought that the previous moment was the worst. This was the worst, being blindfolded and tied in the back of a car and knowing that the soft, gasping sound was Ronan Lynch choking for breath every time he waded back to consciousness.
So much of Ronan was bravado, and there was none left. And Adam was nothing but a weapon to kill him faster. It felt like years ago that he had made his bargain with Cabe's water. "I will be your hands. I will be your eyes." How horrified Gansey had been. And maybe he had been right. Because here was Adam stripped of all of his options, rendered so easily and simply powerless. His thoughts were a battlefield now, and Adam ran away into the blackness of the blindfold.
It was a dangerous game, scrying when Cave's water was so endangered when everyone else would be too busy to notice if he also began to die in the back seat. But it was the only way he could survive being so close to Ronan's pained gasps. He wheeled far and fast, throwing his unconscious far away from his conscious thoughts, as far away as he could get from the truth of the car, as quickly as he could manage it. There was very, very little Cabe's water left. Mostly darkness. Maybe he wouldn't find his way back to his corrupted body. Maybe he would be lost, like Persephone. Persephone. As soon as he thought her name, he realized that she was with him. He couldn't tell how he knew, since he couldn't see her. In fact, he couldn't see anything. In fact, he found that he was once more intensely aware of the fabric of the blindfold against his eyes and the dull ache of his fingers braided and jammed against each other. Once more intensely aware of his physical reality, once more grounded inside his useless body. "You pushed me back here," he accused.
"Ish," she replied. "Mostly, you let yourself get pushed."
He didn't know what to say to her. He was too painfully glad to feel her presence again. It was not that Persephone, vague Persephone, was a creature given to providing comfort. But her brand of sense and wisdom and rules had comforted him greatly when he was chaos. And even though she had not yet really said anything to him, the mere recollection of that comfort gave him a burst of outsized happiness. "I'm ruined."
"Hmm."
"It's my fault."
"Hmm."
"Ganzi was right."
"Hmm."
"Stop saying
hmm." "Then perhaps you should stop saying things you got tired of saying to me weeks ago."
"My hands, though. My eyes." When he named them, he felt them. The clawing hands, the rolling eyes. They were thrilled by the destruction of Ronan. This was their purpose. How they longed to help in that dreadful task.
"Who did you make that deal with?"
"Cabe's water."
"Who is using your hands?"
"The demon."
"That is not the same thing."
Adam didn't reply. Once again, Persephone was giving him advice that sounded good but was impossible to use in the real world. It was wisdom, not an actionable item.
"You made your deal with Cabe's water, not with a demon. Even though they look the same and feel the same, they are not the same."
"They feel the same."
"They are not the same. The demon has no claim to you. You didn't choose the demon. You chose Cape's water."
"I don't know what to do," Adam said.
"Yes, you do. You have to keep choosing it."
But Cabe's water was dying. Soon there might be no Cabe's water left to choose. Soon it might just be Adam's mind, Adam's body, and the demon. He didn't say it out loud. It didn't matter. In this place, his thoughts and his words were the same thing.
"That does not make you a demon. You will be one of those gods without magic powers. What are they called?"
"I don't think there is a word."
"King. Probably. I am going to go now."
"Persephone, please."
"I
miss you." He was alone. She had gone. He was left, as always, with equal parts comfort and uncertainty. The feeling that he knew how to move forward, the doubt that he was capable of executing it. But this time, she'd come an awfully long way to give him his lesson. He didn't know if she could see him anymore now, but he didn't want to let her down. And the truth was that if he thought about the things that he loved about Cabe's water, it wasn't difficult at all to tell the difference between the demon and it. They grew from the same soil, but they were nothing like each other. "These eyes and hands are mine," Adam thought. And they were. He didn't have to prove it. It was a fact as soon as he believed it. He turned his head and rubbed the blindfold off his eyes. He saw the end of the world. 63. The demon slowly worked at the fibers of the dreamer.
They were difficult things to unmake, dreamers. So much of a dreamer didn't exist inside a physical body. So many complicated parts of them snarled in the stars and tangled in tree roots. So much of them fled down rivers and exploded through the air between raindrops. This dreamer fought. The demon was about unmaking and nothingness, and dreamers were about making and fullness. This dreamer was all of that to an extreme, a new king in his invented kingdom. He fought. The demon kept pulling him unconscious, and in those short bursts of blackness, the dreamer snatched at light, and when he swam back to consciousness, he thrust the dream into reality. He shaped them into flapping creatures and earthbound stars and flaming crowns and golden notes that sang by themselves and mint leaves scattered across the blood-streaked pavement and scraps of paper with jagged handwriting on them. Hungawibus et rostro. But he was dying.
64. Wanting to live, but accepting death to save others. That was courage. That was to be Ganzi's greatness. It has to happen now, he said. I have to do the sacrifice now. Now that the moment had come, there was a certain glory to it. He didn't want to die, but at least he was doing it for these people, his found family. At least he was doing it for people he knew were going to really live. At least he was not dying pointlessly stung by wasps. At least this time, it would matter. This was where he was going to die. On a sloped field speckled with oak leaves. Black cattle grazed far up the hill, tails swishing as the rain fell in fitful spells. The grass was strikingly green for October, and the shock of color against the fall-bright leaves made it look like a calendar photo. There was no one else around for miles. The only thing out of place was the flower-strewn river of blood across the winding road and the young man dying in his car.
But we're nowhere near Caveswater,
Blue said. Ronan's phone was ringing again. Declan, Declan, Declan. Everything was falling apart everywhere. Ronan flickered briefly back into consciousness, his eyes awash with black, a rain of flickering pebbles scattering from his hand and skidding to a mucky stop on the bloody pavement.
Terribly, the orphan girl was just watching blankly from the back seat, black slowly running from her closest ear. When she saw Ganzi looking at her, she simply mouthed, "Kira," without any sound coming out.
"Are we on the ley line?" All that mattered was that they were on the line so the sacrifice would count to kill the demon.
Yes, but we're nowhere near Caveswater. You'll just die.
One of the great things about Blue Sergeant was that she never really gave up hope. He would have told her this, but he knew it would only upset her more. He said, "I can't watch Ronan die, Blue. And Adam, and Matthew, and all this, we don't have anything else. You already saw my spirit. You already know what we chose." Blue closed her eyes, and two tears ran out of them. She did not cry noisily or in a way that asked him to say anything different. She was a hopeful creature, but she was also a sensible creature.
"Untie me," Adam said from the back seat. "If you're going to do it now, for God's sake, untie me."
His blindfold was off, and he was looking at Ganzi, his eyes his own instead of the demon's. His chest was moving fast. If there was any other way, Ganzi knew Adam would have told him. "Is it safe?" Ganzi asked.
"Safe as life," Adam replied. "Untie me!"
Henry had been waiting for something to do. He clearly did not know how to process this without having a task, so he leapt to untie Adam. Shaking his reddened wrists free of the ribbon, Adam first touched the top of the orphan girl's head and whispered, "It's going to be all right." And then he climbed out of the car and stood before Ganzi. What could they possibly say? Ganzi bumped fists with Adam, and they nodded at each other. It was stupid, inadequate. Ronan clawed briefly back to consciousness. Flowers spilled out of the car in shades of blue,
Ganzi had never seen. Ronan was frozen in place, as he always was after a dream, and black slowly oozed out of one of his nostrils. Ganzi had never understood really what it meant for Ronan to have to live with his nightmares. He understood it now. There was no time. "Thanks for everything, Henry," Ganzi said. "You're a prince among men." Henry's face was blank. Blue said, "I hate this." It was right, though. Ganzi felt the feeling of time slipping. One last time. The sense of having done this before. He gently laid the backs of his hands on her cheeks. He whispered, "It'll be okay. I'm ready. Blue, kiss me." The rain spattered about them, kicking up splashes of red-black, making the petals around them twitch. Dream things from Ronan's newly healed imagination piled around their feet. In the rain, everything smelled of these mountains in fall. Oak leaves and hay fields, ozone and dirt turned over. It was beautiful here, and Ganzi loved it. It had taken a long time, but he'd ended up where he wanted after all. Blue kissed him. He had dreamt of it often enough, and here it was, willed into life. In another world, it would just be this, a girl softly pressing her lips to a boy's. But in this one, Ganzi felt the effects of it at once. Blue, a mirror, an amplifier, a strange half-tree soul with leyline magic running through her. And Ganzi, restored once by the leyline's power, given a leyline heart, another kind of mirror. And when they were pointed at each other, the weaker one gave. Ganzi's leyline heart had been gifted, not grown. He pulled back from her. Out loud, with intention, with the voice that left no room for doubt, he said, "Let it be to kill the demon." Right after he spoke, Blue threw her arms tightly around his neck. Right after he spoke, she pressed her face into the side of his. Right after he spoke, she held him like a shouted word. He fell quietly from her arms. He was a king. 65. Depending on where you began the story, it was about Noah Cherney. The problem with being dead was that your story stopped being lines and started being circles. They started to begin and end in the same moment, the moment of dying. It was difficult to focus on other ways of telling stories and to remember that the living were interested in the specific order of events. Chronology. That was the word. Noah was more interested in the spiritual weight of a minute, getting killed. There was a story. He never stopped noticing that moment. Every time he saw it, he slowed and watched it, remembering precisely every physical sensation that he had experienced during the murder. Murder. Sometimes he got caught on a loop of constantly understanding that he had been murdered, and rage made him smash things in Ronan's room or kick the mint pot off Ganzi's desk or punch in a pane of glass on the stairs up to the apartment. Sometimes he got caught in this moment instead. Ganzi's death. Watching Ganzi die again and again and again. Wondering if he would have been that brave in the forest if Welk had asked him to die instead of forcing him to. He didn't think he would have. He wasn't sure they'd been that sort of friends. Sometimes, when he went back to see the still-living Ganzi, he forgot whether or not this Ganzi already knew that he was going to die. It was easy to know everything when time was circular, but it was hard to remember how to use it. "Ganzi," he said, "that's all there is." This was not the right moment. Noah had been sucked into Ganzi's spirit life instead, which was a different line entirely. He moved away from it. It was not a spatial consideration, but a timing one. It was a bit like playing skip rope with three. Noah could no longer remember who he had done such a thing with, only that he must have done it at some point to remember it. You had to wait for the right moment to move forward or you got repelled by rope. He didn't always remember why he was doing this, but he remembered what he was doing, looking for the first time Gansey had died. He couldn't remember the first time that he'd made this choice. It was hard now to remember what was remembering and what was actually repeating. He wasn't even certain now which he was doing. Noah just knew he had to keep doing it until the moment. He only had to stay solid long enough to make sure it stuck. Here he was, Gansey, so young, twitching and dying in the leaves of a wood at the same time that Noah, miles away, had been twitching and dying in the leaves of a different wood. All times were the same. As soon as Noah died, his spirit, full of the ley line, favored by Cave's water, had felt spread over every moment he had experienced and was going to experience. It was easy to look wise when time was a circle. Noah crouched over Gansey's body. He said for the last time, "You will live because of Glendower. Someone else on the ley line is dying when they should not, and so you will live when you should not." Gansey died. "Goodbye," Noah said. "Don't throw it away." He quietly slid from time. 66. Blue Sergeant had forgotten how many times she'd been told that she would kill her true love. Her family traded in predictions. They read cards and they held seances and they upturned teacups onto saucers. Blue had never been part of this, except in one important way. She was the person with the longest standing prediction in the household. "If you kiss your true love, he'll die." For most of her life, she'd considered how it would happen. She'd been warned by all sorts of clairvoyance. Even without a hint of psychic ability, she had lived enmeshed in a world that was equal parts present and future, always knowing in a certain sense where she was headed. But not anymore. Now, she was looking at Gansey's dead body in its rain-spattered V-neck sweater and thinking, "I have no idea what happens now." The blood was draining off the highway, and crows had landed a few yards off to peck at it. All active signs of demonic activity had vanished at once.
"Get him," Ronan started, and then had to gather himself to finish in a snarl. "Get him off the road. He's not an animal." They dragged Gansey's body into the green grass by the side of the little road instead.
He still looked entirely alive. He'd only been dead for a minute or two. And there just wasn't a lot of difference between being dead and sleeping until things started to go bad. Ronan crouched beside him, black still smeared on his face under his nose and around his ears. His dreamt firefly rested on Gansey's heart.
"Wake up, you bastard," he said. "You fucker. I can't believe that you would..." And he began to cry. Beside Blue and Henry, Adam was dry-cheeked and dead-eyed. But the orphan girl hugged his arm as if comforting a weeper as he stared off into nothingness.
His watch twitched the same minute over and over. Blue had stopped crying. She'd used up all her tears beforehand. The sounds of Henrietta made their way to them. An ambulance or a fire truck was wailing somewhere. Engines were revving. A loudspeaker was going. In a tree close by, little birds were singing. The cows were starting to move down the field toward them, curious about how long they'd been parked there.
"I don't really know what to do," Henry confessed. "This isn't how I thought it would end. I thought we were all going to Venezuela."
He was wry and pragmatic, and Blue saw that this was the only way he could cope with the fact of Richard Gansey's dead body lying in the grass.
"I can't think about that," Blue said truthfully. She couldn't really think about anything. Everything had come to an end at once. Every bit of her future was now unwritten for the first time in her life. Were they supposed to call 911? Practical concerns of dead true loves stretched out in front of her, and she found she couldn't focus on any of them clearly. I can't really think at all. It's like I have a lampshade over my head. I keep waiting for... I don't know.
Adam suddenly sat down. He said nothing at all, but he covered his face with his hands. Henry sucked in a very uneven breath.
We should get the cars out of the road, he said. Now that things are not bleeding, traffic will... He stopped himself.
This isn't right. Blue shook her head.
I just don't understand, Henry said. I was so sure that this was going to change everything. I didn't think it would end like this.
I always knew it was going to end like this, she said, but it still doesn't feel right. Would this ever feel right?
Henry shifted from foot to foot, looking for other cars, making no move toward their cars despite his earlier care about traffic. He looked at his watch. Like Adams, it was still restlessly trying out the same few minutes, though not as violently as before, and repeated, I just don't understand. What is the point of magic, if not for this?
For what?
Henry stretched a hand over Gansey's body.
For him to be dead. You said you were Gansey's magicians. Do something.
I'm not a magician.
You just killed him with your mouth, Henry pointed at Ronan.
That one just dreamed that pile of shit beside the car. That one saved his own life at the school when things fell from a roof.
Adam's attention focused sharply at this. Grief sharpened his tone to a knife's edge. That's different.
Different how?
It breaks the rules, too.
Because it is one thing to break the rules of physics with magic, Adam snapped back. It's a different thing to bring someone back from the dead.
But Henry was relentless.
Why? He's already come back once.
It was impossible to argue with that, Blue said.
That required a sacrifice, though. Noah's death,
Henry said.
So find another sacrifice.
Adam growled. Are you offering? Blue understood his anger, though. Any degree of hope was impossible to bear in this situation. There was silence. Henry looked down the road again. Finally, he said,
Be magicians.
Shut up, Ronan suddenly snapped. Shut up! I can't take it. Just leave it. Henry actually stepped back a step, so fierce was Ronan's grief. They all fell silent. Blue couldn't stop looking at the time twitching away on Henry's watch. It was becoming ever less frantic the further they got from the kiss, and Blue couldn't help but dread when time returned entirely to normal. It felt like Gansey would really, truly be dead when it did. The minute hand quivered. It quivered again. Blue was already tired of a timeline without Gansey in it. Adam looked up from where he was folded in the grass. His voice was small. What about Cape's water?
What about it? Ronan asked. It's not powerful enough to do anything anymore.
I know, Adam replied. But if you asked, it might die for him.
67. Depending on where you began the story, it was about Cape's water. Cape's water was not a forest. Cape's water was a thing that happened to look like a forest right now. This was a peculiar magic that meant that it was always very old and very young at once. It had always been, and yet it was always learning itself. It was always alive and waiting to be alive again. It had never died on purpose before, but it had never been asked.
Please, the Grey Warren said, Amabote.
It was not possible. Not like he thought. A life for a life was a good sacrifice, a brilliant base for a fantastic and peculiar magic. But Cape's water was not quite mortal, and the boy the humans wanted to save was. It was not as simple as Cape's water dying and him rising. If it was going to be anything at all, it would have to be about Cape's water making some essential part of itself human-shaped. And even Cape's water wasn't certain if that was possible. The magician boy's mind moved through Caveswater's tattered thoughts, trying to understand what was possible, projecting images of his own to help Caveswater understand the goal of resurrection. He did not realize that it was a much harder concept for him to grasp than Caveswater. Caveswater was always dying and rising again. When all times were the same, resurrection was merely a matter of moving consciousness from one minute to another. Living forever was not difficult for Caveswater to imagine. Reanimating a human body with a finite timeline was. Caveswater did its best to show him the reality of this, though nuance was difficult with the ley line as worn down as it was. What little communication they could muster was only possible because the psychic's daughter was there with him, as she had always been there in some form, amplifying both Caveswater and the magician. What Caveswater was trying to make them understand was that Caveswater was about creation, making, building. It could not unmake itself for the sacrifice because it was against its nature. It could not quite die to bring a human back just as before. It would have been easier to make a copy of the human who had just died, but they did not want a copy. They wanted the one they had just lost. It was impossible to bring him back unchanged. This body of his was irreversibly dead. But it might be able to refashion him into something new. It just had to remember what humans were like. Images flashed from Caveswater to the magician, and he whispered them to the psychic's daughter. She began to direct her mirror magic at the trees that remained in Caveswater, and she whispered, "Please," as she did, and the Tira Elintes recognized her as one of theirs. Then Caveswater began to work. Humans were such tricky and complicated things. As it began to spin life and being out of its dream stuff, the remaining trees began to hum and sing together. Once upon a time, their songs had sounded different, but in this time, they sang the songs the Grey Warn had given to them. It was a wailing, ascending tune, full of both misery and joy at once. And as Caveswater distilled its magic, these trees began to fall one by one. The psychic's daughter's sadness burst through the forest, and Caveswater accepted that too, and put it into the life it was building. Another tree fell, and another, and Caveswater kept returning again and again to the humans who had made the request. It had to remember what they felt like. It had to remember to make itself small enough. As the forest diminished, the Grey Warren's despair and wonder surged through Caveswater. The trees sang soothingly back to him, a song of possibility and power and dreams. And then Caveswater collected his wonder and put it into the life it was building. And finally, the magician's wistful regret twisted through what remained of the trees. Without this, what was he? Simply human. 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 Caveswater pressed leaves against his cheek one last time, and then they took that humanity for the life it was building. It was nearly human-shaped. It would fit well enough. Nothing was ever perfect. Make way for the Raven King. The last tree fell, and the forest was gone, and everything was absolutely silent. Blue touched Gansey's face. She whispered, "Wake up." Epilogue. June evenings in Singer's Falls were beautiful things. Lush and dark, the world painted in complicated greens, trees, everywhere trees. Adam drove the winding road back to Henrietta in a slick little BMW that smelled of Ronan. The radio was playing Ronan's terrible techno, but Adam didn't turn it off. The world felt enormous. He was going back to the trailer park. It was time.
It was a 30-minute drive from the barns to the trailer park, so he had plenty of time to change his mind to go back to St. Agnes or Monmouth Manufacturing instead. But he drove past Henrietta to the trailer park, and then he drove down the long, bumpy drive to the trailers, his tires kicking up a disintegrating thunderhead of dust behind him. Dogs leapt out to chase the car, vanishing by the time he arrived in front of his old home. He didn't have to ask if he was really doing this. He was here, wasn't he? Adam climbed the rickety stairs. These stairs, once painted, now peeled and cracked, drilled with the perfectly round tracks of carpenter bees, weren't very different from the stairs up to his apartment above St. Agnes, just fewer of them here. At the top of the stairs, he studied the door, trying to decide if he should knock or not. It had not been that many months since he had lived here, coming and going without announcement, but it felt like it had been years. He felt taller than he had been when he had been here last, too, although he surely couldn't have grown that much since the summer before. This was not his real home anymore, so he knocked. He waited, hands in the pockets of his pressed khaki slacks, looking at the clean toes of his shoes and then up again at the dusty door. The door opened, and his father stood there, eye to eye with him. Adam felt a little more kindly to the past version of himself, the one who had been afraid of turning out like this man. Because although Robert Parrish and Adam Parrish didn't look alike at first glance, there was something introverted and turned inward about Robert Parrish's gaze that reminded Adam of himself. Something about the knit of the eyebrows was similar, too. The shape of the furrow between them was precisely the shape of the continued difference between what life was supposed to be and what life was actually like. Adam was not Robert, but he could have been, and he forgave that past Adam for being afraid of the possibility. Robert Parrish stared at his son. Just behind him in the dim room, Adam saw his mother, who was looking past Adam to the BMW. "Invite me in," Adam said. His father lingered, one nostril flaring, but he retreated back into the house. He turned a hand in a sort of mocking invitation, a gesture of pretend fealty to a false king. Adam stepped in. He had forgotten how compressed their lives were here. He had forgotten how the kitchen was the same as the living room, was the same as the master bedroom, and on the other side of the main room, Adam's tiny bedroom. He could not blame them for resentfully carving out that space. There was no other place to be in this house that was not looking at each other. He had forgotten how claustrophobia had driven him outside as much as fear. "Nice of you to call," his mother said. He always forgot how she used to drive him out, too. Her words were a more slippery kind of assault, sliding out of his memory more easily than his father's actual blows, sliding in between the ribs of that younger Adam when he wasn't paying attention. There was a reason why he had learned to hide alone, not with her. "I missed you at graduation today," Adam replied evenly. "I didn't feel welcome," she said. "I asked you to come. You made it ugly." "It wasn't me who made it ugly." Her eyes glanced off him, most of her vanishing at the first sign of active conflict. "What do you want, Adam?" his father asked. He was still staring at Adam's clothing as if he thought that it might be what had changed. "I don't guess it's because you're begging to move back in now that you all graduated and fancy and driving your boyfriend's Beamer." "I came to see if there was any possibility of having a normal relationship with my parents before I leave for college," Adam replied. His father's mouth worked. It was hard to tell if he was shocked by the content of Adam's statement or just by the fact of Adam's voice at all. It was not a thing that had been heard often in this room. It was perplexing to Adam how he had regarded this as normal for so long. He remembered how the neighbors used to turn away from his bruised face. He used to think stupidly that they said nothing because they thought he had somehow deserved it. Now, though, he wondered how many of them had huddled on the floor in front of their sofas, or hidden in their rooms, or cried beneath the little porch in the bitter rain. He felt a sudden urge to save all these other Adams hidden in plain view, though he didn't know if they would listen to him. It struck him as a Gansey or a Blue impulse,
and as he held that tiny heroic spark in his mind, he realized that it was only because he believed that he had saved himself that he could imagine saving someone else.
"You're the one who made this impossible," his father said. "You're the one who made this ugly, just like your mother said."
He seemed petulant to Adam now, not fearsome.
Everything about his body language, shoulders curled like a fern, chin tucked, indicated that he would no sooner hit Adam than he would hit his boss.
The last time he had raised a hand to his son, he'd had to pull a bloody thorn out of it, and Adam could see the disbelief of that moment still registering in him. Adam was other. Even without Cabe's water's force, he could feel it glimmering coolly in his eyes, and he did nothing to disguise it. Magician.
"It was ugly way before then, Dad," Adam replied. "Do you know I can't hear out of this ear? You were talking over me in the courtroom when I said it before."
His father made a scornful noise, but Adam interrupted him. "Gansey took me to the hospital. That should have been you, Dad. I mean, it shouldn't have happened at all, but if it had really been an accident, it should have been you in the room with me."
Even as he said the words that he'd wanted to say, he couldn't believe that he was saying them. Had he ever talked back to his father and been certain he was right, and been able to look him right in the eye the entire time? He couldn't quite believe that he was not afraid. His father was not frightening unless you were already afraid.
His father blustered and put his hands in his pockets. "I'm deaf in this ear, Dad, and that was you."
Now his father looked at the floor, and that was how Adam knew that he believed him. It was possible that was the only thing Adam had actually needed out of this meeting, his father's averted eyes, the certainty that his father knew what he had done.
His father asked, "What do you want from us?"
On the way over, Adam had considered this. What he truly wanted was to be left to his own devices, not by his actual father, who could no longer truly intrude on Adam's life, but by the idea of his father, a more powerful thing in every way. He replied, "Every time I can't tell where someone's calling me from in a room, and every time I smash my head into the side of the shower, and every time I accidentally start to put my earbuds in both ears, I think about you.
Do you think there can be a future when that's not the only time I think about you?"
He could tell from their faces that the answer to this was not likely to be yes anytime soon, but that was all right. He hadn't come with any expectations, so he was not disappointed.
"I reckon I don't know," his father replied finally. "You've grown up into someone I don't like very much, and I'm not afraid to say it."
"That's fair," Adam said. He didn't much care for his father either. Gansey would have said, "I appreciate your honesty." And Adam borrowed from that memory of polite power. "I appreciate your honesty." His father's face indicated that Adam had just illustrated his point perfectly. His mother spoke up.
"I'd like you to call. I'd like to know what you're doing."
She lifted her head, and the light through the window made a perfect square of light on her glasses. And just like that, Adam's thoughts flashed a long time, his logic following the same channels his psychic sense used. He could see himself knocking, her standing on the other side of the door, not answering. He could see himself knocking, her standing around the back of the trailer, holding her breath until he was gone. He could even see himself calling, and the phone ringing as she held it in her hands. But he could also see her opening the college brochure. He could see her clipping his name out of a newspaper, putting a photo of him in his smart jacket and nice pants and easy smile on the fridge. At some point she had released him, and she didn't want him back. She just wanted to see what happened. But that was all right, too. It was something. He could do that. In fact, that was probably all he could do. He knocked on the cabinet beside him once, thoughtful, and then he took out the BMW keys. "I'll do that," he said. He waited just a moment longer, giving them the opportunity to fill the space, to exceed expectation. They did not. Adam had set the bar at precisely the height they could jump and no higher. "I'll let myself out," he said. He did. On the other side of Henrietta, Gansey and Blue and Henry were just climbing out of the pig. Henry was last out as he had been riding in the back, and he squeezed out from behind the passenger seat as if he were being calved.
He shut the door and then frowned at it.
You have to slam it, Gansey said. Henry shut it.
Slam it, Gansey repeated.
Henry slammed it.
So violent, he said.
They were here in this remote location because of Ronan. He had given them vague instructions that afternoon. Apparently, they were on a scavenger hunt for Blue's graduation gift. She'd been out of school for weeks, and Ronan had implied that a gift was waiting, but he'd refused to relinquish directions to it until Gansey and Henry had also graduated.
You meant to use it together, he had said ominously.
They had asked him to come, both to graduation and on this scavenger hunt, but he replied merely that both locations were full of bad memories for him, and he'd see them on the other side. So now, they walked down a dirt drive toward a dense tree line that hid everything beyond it from their view. It was pleasantly warm. Insects made themselves cozy in the teens' shirts and around their ankles. Gansey had the sense of doing this before, but he couldn't tell if he had or not. He knew now that the feeling of time slipping that he'd lived with for so long was not a product of his first death, but rather his second. A byproduct of the bits and bobs Cabeswater had assembled to give him life again. Humans were not meant to experience all times at once, but Gansey had to do it anyway. Blue reached over to take his hand as they walked, and they swung this knot of their fingers between them merrily. They were free. 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 School was over, and summer stretched before them. Gansey had bid for a gap year and won. Henry had already planned on one. It was all convenient, as Blue had spent months planning how to cheaply hike across the country post-graduation, destination life. It was better with company. It was better with three. Three, Persephone had always said, was the strongest number. Now they broached the tree line and found themselves in a massive overgrown field of the sort that was not uncommon in this part of Virginia. The furry lamb's ears were getting tall already among the grass. The thistles were still short and sneaky. Oh, Ronan, Gansey said, although Ronan was not there to hear it because he had just realized where Ronan's directions had taken them. The field was filled with cars. They were all mostly identical. They were all mostly a little strange in one way or another. They were all mostly white Mitsubishis. The grass growing up around them and the pollen clouding their windshields made the scene rather apocalyptic. I don't want any of these for our great American road trip, Henry said with distaste. I don't care if it's free, and I don't care if it's magical.
Concur, said Gansey.
Blue, however, seemed unconcerned. He said there was one here that we'd know was for us.
You knew it was a car? Gansey demanded. He'd been unable to get the smallest of hints from Ronan.
I wasn't going to follow his directions without any information at all, Blue retorted. They waded through the grass, locusts whirring up before them. Blue and Henry were intently searching, comparing the vehicles. Gansey was dawdling, feeling the summer evening fill his lungs. It was this widening gyre of his path that brought him to the graduation gift. Guys, I found it. It was the obvious outlier. A furiously orange old Camaro parked in the midst of all the new Mitsubishis. It was so obviously identical to the pig that Ronan must have dreamt it.
Ronan thinks he's so funny, Gansey said as Blue and Henry made their way to him.
Henry picked a tick off his arm and threw it into the field to suck on someone else.
He wants you guys to drive matching cars? That seems sentimental for a man without a soul.
He told me that it had something I'm going to love under the hood, Blue said.
She prowled round to the front and fumbled for the hood release. Hefting it open, she began to laugh.
They all peered inside and Gansey laughed too, because inside the engine bay of this Camaro was nothing. There was no engine, no inner workings, just empty space cleared down to the grass growing by the tires.
The ultimate green car, Gansey said at the same time that Henry said, do you think it really runs?
Blue clapped her hands and jumped up and down. Henry snapped a picture of her doing it, but she was too cheerful to make a face at him. Skipping around to the driver's side, she got in. She was barely visible over the dash. Her smile was still enormous. Ronan was going to be sorry he'd missed it, but Gansey understood his reasons. A second later, the engine roared to life. Or rather, the car roared to life.
who knew what was even making the sound, Blue made a ridiculous whooping sound of glee. The year stretched out in front of him, magical and enormous and entirely unwritten. It was marvelous.
"Do you think it ever breaks down?" Gansey shouted over the sound of the not engine. Henry began to laugh.
"This is going to be a great trip," he said.
Depending on where you began the story, it was about this place. The long stretch of mountain that straddled a particularly potent segment of the ley line. Months before, it had been Cave's Water, populated by dreams blooming with magic. Now, it was merely an ordinary Virginia forest, green thorns and soft sycamores and oaks and pine trees, everything slender from the effort of growing through rock. Ronan guessed it was pretty enough, but it was no Cave's Water. Off along one of the banks, a scrawny, hooved girl crashed merrily through the undergrowth, humming and making disgusting chewing noises. Everything in the forest was interesting to her, and interesting meant tasting it. Adam said she was a lot like Ronan. Ronan was going to choose to take that as a compliment. "Opal," he snapped, and she spat out a mouthful of mushroom. "Stop dicking around." The girl galloped to catch up with him, but she didn't pause when she reached him. She preferred to form a lopsided perimeter of frantic activity around his person. Anything else might give the appearance of willing obedience, and she would do a lot to avoid that. Up ahead, Chainsaw shouted, "Kira!" She kept hollering until Ronan had caught up with her. Sure enough, she had found something out of place. He kicked through the leaves. It was a metal artifact that looked centuries old. It was the wheel off a 1973 Camaro. It matched the ancient, impossible wheel they'd found on the ley line months earlier. Back then, Ronan had taken that to mean that at some point in the future they would wreck the Camaro in the pursuit of Glendower, and the ley line's bending of time would have sent them back in time and then forward again, all times being the same-ish on the ley line. But it looked as if they hadn't gotten to that place yet. They had future adventures waiting for them on the ley line. It was a thrilling and terrifying prospect. "Good find, brat," he told Chainsaw. "Let's go home." Back at the barns, Ronan thought about all the things he liked and didn't like about Cave's Water, and what he would do differently if he was to manifest it now. What would give it more protection against a threat in the future? What would make it better able to connect with other places like Cave's Water on the line? What would make it a truer reflection of himself? Then, holding these things in his head, he climbed up onto the roof and gazed up at the sky. Then he closed his eyes and he began to dream. This is Will Patton. We hope that you have enjoyed The Raven King, Book 4 of The Raven Cycle by Maggie Stiefvater. This program was produced and directed by Scott Sherritt. Executive producer, Paul R. Gagne. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. Recorded by Mike Shear at Charleston Sound in Charleston, South Carolina. Original music composed and performed by Maggie Stiefvater. Print edition published by Scholastic, Inc. Text and music copyright 2016 by Maggie Stiefvater. Production copyright 2016 by Scholastic, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.